call to a second pastor, and so that's one of the processes that we're going through as a church, a pastor search process for an assistant pastor. I'm so glad to be able to worship with you this morning. We are going through a sermon series called Love, based on 1 Corinthians chapter 3, which is perhaps one of the most well-known pieces of literature on love in all history. Certainly one of the most well-known chapters in the Bible. It's been called the Love Chapter. And so we've been using 1 Corinthians chapter 13 as a roadmap to help us explore what love is, why we need it, and how it can change our lives. And so today we're going to look at how love is not insistent. And we'll be looking at two scriptures, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 8. And then we'll also look at a story, a parable. It's been called the parable of the prodigal son from Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. So here is 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 8. This is the reading of God's word. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. And he said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him? And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. May God add his blessings to the reading of his word. A few years ago, there was a study done at Columbia Business School, and in this study, they took business students, they paired them up, and they had them do these mock negotiations. They had to negotiate a business deal. One person would win, one person would lose, and then after the three rounds of negotiations, they would debrief with each party of the negotiation. And the questions they would ask them were surrounding the perception of pushiness. They would ask them, do you think you were pushy in your negotiations? Do you think the other person was pushy? Do you think they thought you were pushy? And here's what they found. They found that 50% of the people who thought they were pushy were actually seen as pushovers. 56% of the people who thought they were pushovers actually were seen as being pushy. And so this study shows us that we really don't have a good idea of how people see us. And no one wants to be pushy. No one wants to be a pushover. We want to be appropriately assertive. We want to be able to negotiate. We want to be able to assert the things that we want, our interests. But there's this fine line where we cross the line and people see us as a jerk because we're pushing too hard, or people see us as a wimp because we're not pushing hard enough. And half the time, for most of us, when we think that we're being too pushy, we're actually pushovers. And when we think that we're being pushovers, we are actually being too pushy. Well, today's passage is really about two sons. And they're actually both pushy, and they're both deathly afraid of being a pushover. At the center of the story is a father who looks a lot like a pushover. But in all of this, God shows us this incredible story of love. And it's a story that shows us how love can liberate us from the fear of being pushy and the fear of being a pushover. And it shows us a different way to relate with one another, a different way to live our lives. So we're going to look at three things as we unpack this story, the story of the prodigal son. We're going to look at, number one, the cost of being pushy. Number two, the cost of being a pushover. And number three, the costly love of a father. That's the outline for today. The cost of being pushy, number one. Number two, the cost of being a pushover. And number three, the costly love of a father. Let's look first at the cost of being pushy. This passage is a parable, and parables are fictional stories that Jesus tells in the New Testament to teach us a lesson. And he tells this story in a group of parables about lost things. Luke chapter 15 contains the parable of the lost coin and the lost parable son and the prodigal son and the lost sheep. It's a story about lost things. And the reason why he tells this story is because these Pharisees, these religious leaders, have begun to notice that Jesus spends way too much time than they're comfortable with sinners. People who are known to be immoral, people who are not part of polite society. And they say, if you look at Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2, it says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. Jesus was constantly criticized for partying too much with sinners. And so as a response to these religious leaders, Jesus tells these parables, and this parable, the parable of the prodigal son, has something to teach us about why he loved to eat with sinners. Now, Jesus could have told the story with a more sympathetic sinner. He could have told a story about someone who had a hard life, and he could have said, look, These sinners that, everyone has a story, and everyone has a reason why they do the things that they do and they make the choices that they make. And you don't know the story of those people that you think are sinners. They've had a hard life. There's a reason why they act the way that they do. He could have told a story that was easier to relate with. A story about someone like them, maybe even a story about a religious leader who had failed morally, and Jesus could have said, "Hey, look, you're just like these sinners, and you're not perfect either. And look at how you might identify with someone who is just like you, who is also a sinner." But he chooses to tell a story of a sinner who is maybe the most unsympathetic character of all his parables. This younger son in this parable is a really horrible human being, especially in the context of the ancient world. The story starts with a man who is wealthy, a man who has many servants, who owns a lot of property, and he has two sons. And one day the younger son comes to his father and he says, "Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me." And this is one of the worst things that anyone could have asked for in the ancient world. Remember that in the first century Palestine, first century Israel, the Middle East, it was a tribal society, a tribal culture. And so to ask your father for your inheritance while he was still alive was not only insulting, but threatened to ruin him financially. He's putting his father in financial jeopardy. The younger son then goes and does what everybody is afraid that he will do. He not only takes the money, but he leaves home. And that's even worse than asking your father for your inheritance while he's still alive. He goes and he leaves the country. He leaves Israel. He leaves the promised land. He liquidates all his property. He takes that cash and he goes and he wastes all of it. Fulfilling every desire of his heart. He lives large, and when he has spent everything, there's a famine. A famine hits this foreign country, and he's completely broke. He's completely alone, and he ends up working for a pig farmer, which would have been offensive to any Jew because it was a sin in the Old Testament for Jewish people to eat pork. And he makes so little money working in this pigsty that he's starving and he wants to eat the pig food, but he can't even do that. Now, this would have been the equivalent of convincing your parents to cash out half of their retirement fund and then give you half of their Social Security and then blowing it all at Las Vegas. Today, we would call that elder abuse. Even in today's society, this is really, really bad. Really horrible people do things like this. But what makes it even worse is that in the ancient world, this was also would have made the younger son a traitor. Because the property that people owned in the promised land was their stake in the country. It was their claim to citizenship. And so the younger son in this story is part elder abuser, part traitor to his nation. To say that he pushed too hard would be an understatement. His story is a warning to everyone that when you push too hard, when you want something and you push too hard, you are going to hurt people and you're going to hurt yourself. You see, that's the problem with being pushy. When we're pushy, when we insist on getting our own way, even if we're being pushy about something good, maybe you're pushy about going to church. And going to church is a good thing, but you're pushy about it. You're pushy with your friends. You're pushy with your family. You're pushy with your children. You're pushy with your siblings. When we're pushy, when we push too hard, it always hurts other people. When we insist on getting our own way, we end up doing damage. Being pushy, insisting on our own way, is like watering an orchid with a fire hose. Right? There's nothing wrong with watering an orchid. Orchids need water. Water is good. But if you use a fire hose to water an orchid, you're going to destroy it. You're not only going to hurt it, you're going to destroy it. An orchid needs to be spritzed, right? And it needs to be watered with a gentle mist. Use too much pressure and you will destroy it. All of you remember the times in your life where people were too pushy with you. It's a lot easier to know when other people are being too pushy than it is to know when you're being too pushy. You know when someone's being too pushy with you because it hurts. You remember when people pushed you too hard to pay way too much for a car that you didn't need. You remember that aggressive salesperson that pressured you. You remember the friend that pressured you to do something that you didn't want to do. You remember that parent that left you to pursue their dreams. They pushed too hard on getting their own way. The parent who was never present when you needed them most. You remember that person at church who always makes you feel guilty. All you need to do is look at them and they make you feel guilty because they're pushy about their particular way of being holy, their particular way of being religious. Pushiness has a cost. And the cost is that we are okay with hurting other people. In the first century rabbinic literature, people like this younger son who blow their family inheritance are cut off from the entire tribe. It's considered a crime against the entire nation. In our world, being cut off from your tribe would be like losing your social security number. When you push too hard, you may find that you get what you want, but you will pay for it with the relationships in your life. People will not want to be close to you. People will not trust you. People will not be vulnerable with you. You will lose the ability to be vulnerable yourself. You will lose the ability to get forgiveness from people or to ask help from people. You will lose the ability to receive unconditional love from anyone. You will lose the ability to receive grace. There is a cost to being pushy. We see it so clearly in the story of the younger son, but he's not the only pushy person in this story. We see a different sort of pushiness in the older son, and he shows us that there is a cost to being a pushover. When you face someone who's being pushy, the last thing you want to do is become a pushover, and that's what's happening with the older son in this story. When the younger son was starving in a pigsty, he finally came to his senses. He remembered how good even the servants had it at his father's home. And so he decided to go back home. He knew his father couldn't take him back as a son. So he came up with this elaborate plan. He wrote this speech. And he was going to go back and tell his father, I've sinned against you. I know I don't even deserve to be your son. Will you just let me have a job? Will you take me back as a servant? I want to be a day laborer. He wanted to become like one of those people that wait outside of Home Depot in the morning looking for work. That's what a day laborer was. That's the kind of job with his father that he was looking for. And so when the younger son returns home, the father not only takes him back, but he throws him a party. The fattened calf that we see in this story is extravagant, right? One normal cow can feed over 800 people. But this wasn't a normal cow. This was a fattened cow. It could have easily fed over 1,000 people, maybe 1,500 people. We don't know how big it was. But this was a big party, not a small party, not a family party. It was a tribal party. It was a party for the entire village. Right? The father not only takes his son back, but lavishes grace and honor on his son. Now, the older son was not home when his younger brother came back. He was out in the fields working. That's what he did. He had a job. He had work to do. He was responsible. He had been working in the field when his younger brother returned. And when he came back, he heard music and he saw dancing. So he calls over one of the servants and asks, what in the world is going on? Right? You only slaughtered a fattened calf for a wedding or maybe for a holy day. It's something that you only did a few times in your lifetime. And so he asks the servant, what is going on? Why are there so many people here? Why the music? Why the food? Is that beef that people are eating? And his father comes out, and then the servant tells him what happened. He tells him, your son has come home. Your father threw him a party. He's accepted him back as a son. And all of a sudden, the older brother starts to get really, really angry. He refuses to enter the village. He refuses to enter the party. And his father comes out and he begs to him. He begs that he would just come in and join in the fun, join in the music, have some beef, have some steak. But the older son stands his ground. And listen to what he says in verses 29 through 30. He says, look, these many years I have served you and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. Don't you get the sense that this older son is mad about more than just the fattened calf? He is. If you listen carefully, he's angry that his father has taken back his younger brother. And he can't even muster the words to call him a brother. He says, this son of yours. Why is he so angry that his father took his brother back? Well, listen to the disgust in the older son's voice in verse 30. He says, when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. He's saying, Dad, you're such a pushover. Don't be an idiot. He blew his inheritance. He lost his chance. No one forced him to make this choice. No one forced him to make these decisions. He shamed you. He dishonored you. He put our family in financial jeopardy. Don't ask me to be a pushover like you are a pushover. There's a cost to being a pushover. In verse 12, we learn that the father actually divided his entire inheritance between the two sons. So the younger son was not the only one that got an inheritance. The older son got inheritance as well. So what that means is that the older son was actually paying the bill for this party. And he's saying, how could you do that without even asking me? How could you expect me to pay for this feast for my ridiculous younger brother? He doesn't deserve this. And you're asking me to pay for his mistakes? You're asking me to pay for his poor life choices? In fact, if you look at the story closely, the older son's paying for more than just the party. Because when the younger son was received back into the inheritance, when he received the robe and the ring and the sandals, he was becoming a son. And that meant that he had an inheritance. He already lost his inheritance. So where was his new inheritance coming from? It was coming from his older brother. And here's this older son saying, Dad, I may be paying for this party, but don't ask me to be a part of it. When someone hurts you by pushing you too hard, by insisting on their own way, you can pay for their mistakes yourself, or you can make them pay. And the older son said, you know, I'm already paying for this party, but I'm going to make my brother pay. I'm not going to let him get close to me again. I'm not going to let him take advantage of me again. I'm not going to let him hurt me again. I'm not going to let him humiliate us again. I'm not going to be a pushover. When someone is pushy with you, the last thing you want to do is to be a pushover. Because being a pushover is costly. It means that you need to pay for the other person's mistakes. You need to absorb all the hurt they gave you. And instead of demanding justice or revenge, instead of getting back at them, you say, I'm just going to take it. I'm hurt and it's okay. The older brother didn't want to pay for his brother's mistakes. He wanted to make his brothers pay. That's probably how these religious leaders were feeling who came to Jesus. They saw these sinners. They saw tax collectors. Maybe they saw prostitutes. Jesus is eating with them. He's feasting with them. He's laughing with them. He's drinking wine. Maybe he's eating steak. And they got mad. They got angry. They're looking at these sinners and they're thinking, those people made their own choices. No one forced them to do do these things. No one forced them to live immoral lives. Why should they get to eat and party with this rabbi? Why should they get to eat and party with Jesus? The thought that a holy person like Jesus would prefer the company of sinners, it just made them angry. It made them feel like pushovers. It made them feel like all their religious obedience was meaningless and worthless. Have you ever wanted to make someone pay for hurting you? Have you ever wanted to make someone pay for their mistakes? Have you ever been afraid of being a pushover? Have you told yourself, if I let people have their way, they will walk all over me, they will treat me like I am worthless, they will treat me like all the good things that I have done, all the good choices that I've made, that they mean nothing? See, the cost of being a pushover is too high. It's too high for any of us to pay. Who wants to be a pushover? But the good news here is that you don't need to be a pushover, that God is actually not asking you to be a pushover. The alternative to being pushy is not to be a pushover. The alternative, the opposite of being pushy, is not to be a pushover. It's to be sacrificial. And that's what we see in the costly love of this father. Pushovers are pushovers because they don't want to get hurt. Pushovers are pushovers because they don't want people to be mad at them. They don't want to have a fight. They want to avoid the fight. Pushovers are pushovers because they're looking out for themselves. It's a form of self-preservation. It's a defense mechanism. Being a pushover is not loving. It's selfish. The opposite of being pushy is to be sacrificial. Because love is sacrificial. Love doesn't insist on its own way. Love is more than willing to absorb the hurt that is sometimes required to care for people. Love values people more than it values money or respect or honor or comfort or ambition. And we see a dramatic picture of sacrificial love in this father. Look at verse 20. This is one of my favorite parts of the story. The father sees his son while he's still far away. You don't accidentally see things that are far away, right? He was looking for his son. He had been looking for his son with regularity, even though this younger son of his insulted him and shamed him and dishonored him and put his entire family in financial jeopardy and was a traitor to his entire nation. Even though his younger son had given up on him and given up on God, he never gave up on his son. His son had committed the worst possible sin that any son in the first century could have committed, short of murdering his father. And the father has decided he's already going to forgive him. If he just shows up, he will forgive him. And so every day he's going out to the outskirts of his village and he's looking far away, looking to see if his son will come back. Day after day, he's patiently waiting for the chance to forgive, for the chance to welcome his son home. And then in verse 20, when he sees his son, the father runs. And maybe you've heard this before in sermons. If you've heard a sermon on the prodigal son, you've probably heard this, that it's undignified for a person of this father's stature to run. Wealthy people in the ancient world did not run. He would have been wearing really, really expensive robes. He was probably one of the richest people in town if he was able to feed over 1,000 people. He had to hike up his robe in order to run because they didn't have paved roads. He was running in the dirt. This would be something like a really wealthy person rolling up the pants on their expensive tuxedo and running on a dirt road to meet someone. It was undignified. It looked desperate. It's just not something that polite, dignified people did. But the father didn't care. He ran shamelessly toward his son. And then the moment he reached his son, before his son could even say a word, he hugged him, he embraced him, and then he kissed him. And notice that the father kisses him before the son can even say, "I'm sorry." The son hasn't even repented. He hasn't even confessed his sin. He hasn't even asked for forgiveness, but the father's already forgiven him. He's kissing him. And in the original Greek of the New Testament, the tense of that word kiss suggests that he's kissing him over and over again. This is not a peck on the cheek. He can't stop kissing his son. The father runs to his son. The son is not running home to his father. The son is maybe afraid. Maybe he's having second thoughts. Maybe he's taking his time. He's still far away. There's no way that anyone could see him. He still has a chance to turn back. He doesn't know what his father will say, what his father will do. He doesn't know what his older brother will do. He doesn't know what the town will do. Will they arrest him? Will they stone him for dishonoring his father? Will they put him to death, which was justifiable by the Old Testament law? And this could be another reason why the father's running to his son. He's saying, "I'm going to get to him before anyone else in the village does, and you're going to have to kill me before you try to kill my son." Then when the son confesses his sin, the father not only gives him forgiveness that he doesn't deserve, but he gives him honor that he doesn't deserve. The Bible tells us that he gave his son the best robe. Where did he get the best robe from? Who would possess the best robe in town? It would be him. He's giving him his best robe. It was his father's robe. And if there was any question by anyone in town where this son stood, was he just a worker, a day laborer? Was he on contract? There would be no question when he walked around town in that robe that he was the son of the wealthiest man in town. He put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and everyone would know that he was not a servant, not a slave, but a son. The father did all of this because he loved his son. He was not a pushover. Pushovers don't give people their best. Pushovers don't go over the top in their kindness. Pushovers give in. They don't go all out. And the father sacrificed his honor, his dignity, his pride. He sacrificed his financial loss, the loss of half his property. And he did it without batting an eye. He threw a feast for the ages for a child who shamed him and cost him dearly. Why? Because he loved him. He loved him. In 1990, Robertson McQuilkin stepped down as the president of Columbia Bible College. And it was a very public event because he was doing it to care for his ailing wife who had Alzheimer's. His friends and his colleagues tried to convince him not to do it. He was a really effective administrator. He had doubled the school size during his time as president of this Bible college and seminary. They said, "Muriel doesn't even know you anymore, doesn't know anything really, so it's time to put her in a nursing home and get on with life." People didn't understand his decision. A healthcare professional who was advising him actually told him this. She said that there were only two reasons that anyone puts a family member with Alzheimer at home instead of putting them in a nursing facility. She says the first reason is economic necessity because they can't afford a nursing home, and the second reason is guilt. And he asked, "What about love?" And she replied, "We put that under the category of guilt." In his resignation speech, here's what McQuilkin said about his decision to resign and of how he loved his wife. He says, "She sacrificed for me for 40 years to make my life possible. So if I cared for her for 40 years, I'd still be in debt." However, there's much more. It's not that I have to. It's that I get to. I love her very dearly. You can tell it's not easy to talk about. She's a delight. And it's a great honor to care for such a wonderful person. Love is not driven by guilt. Love is driven by delight. And the father in this story delighted in his son, no matter how badly he had sinned, no matter how badly he had messed up his life, he delighted in him. God the Father did not sacrifice Jesus to save you out of guilt. He chose to save you out of love and delight. And maybe some of you in this room, you're wondering, I've messed up my life so badly. I'm so far from God right now. I don't know if I could even face him again. I don't know if I will ever be close to God the way I once was. And you need to hear this, that God does not love you out of guilt. He doesn't feel obligated to love you. He gets to love you because he delights in you. And that is why he went out over the top. He went all out by sending Jesus to the cross to die for you. All the proof you need that God delights in you is to look at the cross and say, that was for me. He died for me. He sacrificed everything for me. He loved me. He delights in me. Let that soak in your heart. Let it marinate in your heart. Let it captivate your imagination, and it will change your life. At the end of the parable, the father tells his older son, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours." Verse 31. He's talking about what happened in verse 12. He's saying, you remember when I divided the inheritance? Everything that I have is already yours. I paid before you paid. You think you're paying your brother, but that's my money. I paid before you paid because I love you and I delight in you. To put it in gambling terms, the older son was playing with house money. House money is when you win in gambling and you use your winnings to gamble. And when you gamble with money that you've won, you can be a lot more risky, because if you lose it, you're not losing your own money, you're losing house money, right? You could still end up ahead or even at a wash, right? You could end up even betting that money. House money is money that you can risk. And God is telling us, if Jesus is your Savior, we're all playing with house money. You have nothing to lose in putting other people before yourself. You have nothing to lose in relinquishing control and not getting your way. You have nothing to lose in forgiving people who have hurt you. You have nothing to lose in showing costly love, paying for the mistakes of others, absorbing the hurt that they've given. You've nothing to lose because God paid first. And everything that he has is already yours. Maybe you feel like a younger son this morning. Will you go back to your father? He delights in you. He's been looking and waiting for you. Go back to him and feel his kisses. He delights in you. Try on his robe of perfect righteousness on for size. Maybe you feel like the older brother in this story, and there are people who have taken advantage of you, people who have walked all over you, people who have been pushy, who have hurt you. Surrender that hurt. Remember that you're playing with house money. Remember that God paid first, and find healing in the knowledge that your Father in heaven delights in you. And then go and show over-the-top love to God. Show over-the-top love to people in your life. Show over-the-top love even to your enemies. Let's pray. Father, as we reflect on this story, we're amazed by the love of this Father. And in many ways, Lord, this is our worst nightmare, that you would ask us to love in this way. And we manage our lives, we navigate in our lives to avoid these kinds of situations. But Lord, when we think about the cross, when we think about how Jesus gave up everything for us, when we think about our inheritance, how it is an inheritance of grace, not one that we earn, not one that we deserve. We're all sinners. We're all hopeless in ourselves. But we have hope when we feel hopeless because you delight in us when you should resent us. And so we pray that you would draw near to every single one of us with your grace this morning, that you would heal us from our hurts, and that you would help us to relinquish control and surrender our pain, and help us, Lord, to love one another and to love this city, to love this world with the costly love that we've received in Jesus. We thank you that you paid first because we never could. And as we come to your table, we ask that you would use this feast, a feast for sinners, to encourage us, to build us up, and to remind us that in Jesus, no one in this room is a slave or a servant or has been rejected, but has been invited in as a son and daughter of the wealthiest being in the universe. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.